Hello again, this is Mrs. English, and I'm going to continue our reading from Robert Fitzgerald's translation of Virgil's Aeneid. You need to have your copy of the book with you as we read, so you can underline and mark the appropriate places. We are ready for Book 2. This is the Aeneid, Book 2. And this, in Book 2, this is where Dido is going to beg Aeneas to tell the story of how the Greeks tricked the Trojans and how the Greeks burned down the city of Troy. So we're going to hear about the Trojan horse. We're going to hear about Laocoon. You had a handout for that last week. We're going to hear that the gods willed Troy to fall. It was fated that they would fall. Hector's ghost is going to tell Aeneas to flee, run from Troy, and the ghost will tell him to go found a new city. We're going to hear about a cool secret passageway, and Priam, King Priam of Troy, will be cursing the hubris, the sin of the Greeks. And then Achilles' son, Neoptolemus, kills Priam right at the altar, which was a horrific thing. Aeneas will see Helen, and Aphrodite stops him, his mother, stops him from killing Helen. Then we'll see Iulus, who now Ascanius, Iulus for Julius Caesar, but it's little Ascanius, Aeneas' son. There's going to be a flame around his head. This, of course, is important, that he's going to be a really important person, kind of like what happened with Achilles when he had that flame around his head. And then Aeneas, of course, is going to be carrying his father. He loses his wife, Creusa, and her ghost tells him to leave. All of that happens here in Book 2. And then Troy's abandoned, and everybody looks to Aeneas to lead them, and they all head for the mountains, and now this is 7 years later. Beginning of Book 2. The room fell silent, and all eyes were on him as Father Aeneas from his high couch began. "Sorrows too deep to tell, Your Majesty. You order me to feel and tell once more how the Danaans leveled in the dust the splendor of our mourned forever kingdom, the Danaans, of course, are the Greeks. Dardanians are Trojans, Danaans are Greeks. Heartbreaking things I saw with my own eyes and was myself a part of. Who could tell them? Even a Myrmidon or a Dilopian, the people of Thessaly, if they're friends from Greek, they're Greek friends, or ruffian of Ulysses." And now you have to know that Ulysses is Odysseus. That is the, this is the Latin form of Odysseus, is Ulysses. "Or ruffian of Ulysses without tears. Now too the night is well along, with dew fall out of heaven and setting stars weigh down our heads toward sleep. But if so great desire moves you to hear the tale of our disasters, briefly recalled, the final throes of Troy, however I may shudder at the memory and shrink again in grief, let me begin." And he begins. Line 18 is beginning to tell the story of Troy. "Knowing their strength, broken in warfare, turned back by the fates, and years, so many years all slipped away, the Danaans, the Greek captains, by the divine handicraft of Pallas Athena, built a horse of timber, tall as a hill," this is the Trojan horse, "and sheathed its ribs with planking of cut pine. This they gave out to be an offering for a safe return by sea, and the word went round, but on the sly they shut in a company, chosen from their picked soldiery by lot, crowding the vaulted caverns in the dark, the horse's belly, with men fully armed." Line 30. "Offshore, there's a long island, Tenedos, famous and rich while King Priam's kingdom lasted, a treacherous anchorage now and nothing more. They crossed to this and hid their ships behind it, on the bare shore beyond. We thought they'd gone, sailing home to Mycenae before the wind. So Teucer's town is freed of her long anguish, gates thrown wide, and out we go in joy to see the Dorian campsites all deserted, the beach they left behind. Here the Dilopians pitch their tents, here cruel Achilles lodged. There lay the ships, and there, formed up in ranks, they came inland to fight us. Of our men, one group stood marveling, gaping up to see the dire gift of the cold, unbedded goddess, the sheer mass of the horse." So the virgin goddess, Athena. "Thiomedes shouts, 'It should be hauled inside the walls.'" So what are they going to do with the Trojan horse? These are those three things. What are they going to do? Actually, four things. What are they going to do? Are they going to bring it inside the city? Are they going to put it out in the sea? Are they going to burn it up? Or are they going to chop it all up? "It should be hauled inside the walls and moored high on the citadel, whether by treason or just because Troy's fate went that way now. Capys opposed him. So did the wiser heads. 'Up into the sea with it,' they said, 'or burn it. Built up a bonfire under it. This trick of the Greeks, a gift no one can trust.'" And this is where that old saying comes from. Never trust a Greek gift. Never trust just a Greek gift? Something like that. I forgot it now. This trick of the Greeks, a gift no one can trust, or cut it open, search the hollow belly. Contrary notions pulled the crowd apart. Next thing we knew, in front of everyone, Laocoon. And this is where you get your handout from last week of the snakes entwining around Laocoon and his two sons. That's this picture. Laocoon, with a great company, came furiously running from the height, and still far off cried out, "Oh, my poor people, men of Troy, what madness has come over you? Can you believe the enemy truly gone? A gift from the Danaans and no ruse? Is that Ulysses' way, Odysseus, as you have known him? Is that what Ulysses? What was Odysseus known? Cunning. So Laocoon is running down, saying, "Don't trust the Greeks bearing gifts. Don't trust a Greek bearing gifts. Achaeans must be hiding in this timber, or it was built to butt against our walls, peer over them into our houses, pelt the city from the sky. Some crookedness is in this thing. Have no faith in the horse. Whatever it is, even when Greeks bring gifts, I fear them all, gifts and all." That's the saying, beware of Greeks bearing gifts, because it refers back to that Trojan horse. He broke off then and rifled his big spear with all his might against the horse's flank, the curve of belly. So Laocoon comes running down saying, no, don't trust. You, are you really so stupid to believe this? And throws a big spear against it. It stuck there, trembling. You think of the boing. And the rounded hull reverberated, groaning at the blow. If the god's will had not been sinister, this is where they blame the gods, if our own minds had not been crazed, he would have made us foul that Argive den with bloody steel, and Troy would stand today, O citadel of Priam, towering still. So Aeneas is telling the queen, it wasn't our fault. If the gods hadn't have been against us, you know, their will was sinister. But now look, hillmen, shepherds of Dardania, raising a shout, dragged in before the king an unknown fellow with hands tied behind. This all as he himself had planned, volunteering, letting them come across him so he could open Troy to the Achaeans. So this is part of the trick that the Greeks, when they took their ships off and hid them, they left one guy behind. They tied him up, they left him behind so that the Trojans would come out, find the horse, find him, and then he's got a lie to tell. Sure of himself, this man was, braced for it either way, to work his trick or die. From every quarter, Trojans run to see him. So all the Trojans come running to see this Greek guy that they left behind. Ring the prisoner round and made a game of jeering at him. Be instructed now in Greek deceptive arts. One barefaced deed can tell you of them all. As the man stood there, shaken and defenseless, looking around at ranks of Phrygians, "Oh God," he said, "what land on earth, what seas can take me in? What's left me in the end, outcast that I am from the Danaans, the Greeks? Now the Dardanians, the Trojans, will have my blood." So this guy all tied up that they left behind fakes like, "Oh no, the Greeks have left me and the Trojans are going to kill me. Now what will I do?" And of course this will cause the Trojans, the Dardanians, to trust him. The whimpering speech brought us up short. We felt a twinge for him. They feel sorry for him. "Let him speak up," we said. "Tell us where he was born, what news he brought, what he could hope for as a prisoner." Taking his time, slow to discard his fright, he said, "I'll tell you the whole truth, my lord, and no matter what may come of it, Argive I am by birth, and will not say I'm not. I am a Greek. The first of all, fortune has made a derelict of Sinan, but the BITCH won't make an empty liar of him, too. Report of Palamedes may have reached you, scion of Balas's line, a famous man who gave commands against the war." So here we have Palamedes. This is a wise Greek guy, slain because of Ulysses, Odysseus. He exposed Ulysses, Odysseus, when you tried to avoid going to war, so you made him seem a traitor. They made him seem a traitor. "Who gave commands against the war? For this, on a trumped-up charge, on perjured testimony, the Greeks put him to death. But now they mourn him. Now he has lost the light. Being kin to him in my first years, I joined him as companion, sent by my poor old father on this campaign. And while he held high rank and influence in royal councils, we did well with honor. Then by the guile and envy of Ulysses, Odysseus, nothing unheard of there." Everybody knows his guile. He left this world, and I lived on but under a cloud in sorrow, raging for my blameless friend's downfall. Demented, too, I could not hold my peace, but said if I had luck, if I had won through again to Argos, I'd avenge him there. And I roused hatred with my talk. So he says, when we get back to Greece, I'm going to avenge his life. And I roused hatred with my talk. I fell afoul now of that man from that time on. Day in, day out, Ulysses, Odysseus, found new ways to bait and terrify me, putting out shady rumors among the troops, looking for weapons he could use against me. He could not rest until Calchas served his turn, Calchas the priest. But why go on? The tale's unwelcome, useless, if Achaeans are all one, and it's enough I'm called Achaean, Greek, then exact the punishment long overdue. The Ithacan desires it, the Atridae would well pay for it. So the Ithacan desires it, that would be Ulysses, Odysseus from Ithaca, Odysseus desires it, and the Atridae, that would be Agamemnon and Menelaus, would well pay for it. So Odysseus would love it if you kill me, and Agamemnon and Menelaus would probably even pay you to kill me. So it's a brilliant strategy. Burning with curiosity, we questioned him, called on him to explain, unable to conceive such a performance, the art of the Pelasgian. He went on, a tremble, as though he feared us. So remember, this is Aeneas telling Dido the whole story of the Trojan horse, and telling it from a Trojan perspective. It's not their fault. Many times the Danaans wished to organize retreat, to leave Troy in the long war, tired out. So many times the Greeks wanted to just leave. If only they had done it, heavy weather at seas closed down on them, or a fresh gale from the southwest would keep them from embarking. Most of all, this figure here, this horse they put together with maple beams, reached its full height. Then wind and thunderstorms rumpled in heaven. So in our quandary, we sent Eurypylus to Phoebus's oracle, and that would be to Delphi. And he brought back this grim reply. So now this prisoner, who's a Greek disguised as a Greek who hates Greeks, is telling them this fake reply from Delphi. Blood and a virgin slain, you give to appease the winds for your first voyage. And so that's the Delphic oracle saying, you sacrificed Iphigenia to Artemis for your first voyage. Troy word, O Danaans, blood again and Argive blood. One life wins your return. So now to get home, they also have to sacrifice somebody. When this got round among the soldiers, gloom came over them and a cold chill that ran to the very marrow. Who had death in store? Whom did Apollo call for? Now the man of Ithaca hailed Calchas. So Odysseus asked Calchas the priestess, out among us in tumult, calling on the seer to tell the true will of the gods. Ah, there were many able to divine the crookedness and cruelty afoot for me, but they looked on in silence. For 10 days the seer kept still, kept under cover, would not speak of anyone or name a man for death. So for 10 days, Calchas kept it to himself who had to die so they could get home. Line 175, till driven to it at last by Ulysses, Odysseus's cries, by prearrangement, he broke silence, barely enough to designate me for the altar. Every last man agreed. The torments each had feared for himself now shifted to another. All could endure. And the infamous day came, the ritual, the salted meal, the fillets. I broke free. I confess it, I broke my chains, hid myself all night in a muddy marsh, concealed by reeds, waiting for them to sail if they were going to. Now no hope is left me of seeing my home country ever again, my sweet children, my father, missed for years. Perhaps the army will demand they pay for my escape, my crime here, and their death. Poor things will be my punishment. Ah, sir, I beg you by the gods above, the powers in whom truth lives, and by what faith remains uncontaminated to men, take pity on pain so great and so unmerited. So this guy just gave a brilliant performance as a Greek guy left behind who they were going to sacrifice, and he escaped, and that's why he's all tied up. For tears we gave him life and pity too. Priam himself ordered the gyves removed and the tight chain between. In kindness then he said to him, so even King Priam had pity on this poor Greek guy all tied up whom they were going to sacrifice for fair winds. Priam has him untied, and they kind of like the guy. Whoever you may be, said Priam, the Greeks are gone. Forget them from now on. You shall be ours. And answer me these questions. Who put this huge thing up, this horse? Who designed it? What do they want with it? Is it religious or a means of war? So Priam has accepted this guy, of course, in perfect hospitality, a stranger, even their enemy, and the enemies have really violated Xenia by offering a gift that is a trick, and by tricking the Trojans by deception. These were his questions. Then the captive, trained in trickery in the stagecraft of Achaia, Greece, lifted his hands unfettered to the stars. "Eternal fires of heaven," he began, "powers inviolable, I swear by thee as by the altars and blaspheming words. Swords I got away from, and the gods' white bands I wore as one chosen for sacrifice. This is justice. I am justified in dropping all allegiance to the Greeks. So I'm not even going to be Greek anymore. I'm just going to be a Trojan. As I had cause to hate them, I may bring into the open what they would keep dark. No laws of my own country bind me now. Only be sure you keep your promises and keep faith, Troy, as you are kept from harm, if what I say proves true, if what I give is great and valuable. The whole hope of the Danaans, the Greeks, and their confidence in the war they started, rested all along in help from Pallas, Athena. Then the night came when Diomedes and that criminal, Ulysses, Odysseus, dared to raid her holy shrine. They killed the guards on the high citadel and ripped away the statue, the Palladium. Now, the Palladium is the little statue sent by Zeus to Dardanus, who was the founder of Troy. And wherever the Palladium goes, there will be a great city. And that's why Aeneas, when he left Troy all burned up, he grabbed the Palladium and took it with him, because he needs to take it all the way to Italy so he can found the city of Rome. The Palladium's a big, big deal. So they killed the guards on the high citadel, ripped away the statue, the Palladium, desecrating with bloody hands the virginal chaplet of the goddess, so they bloodied her wreath or her garland of the goddess. After that, Danaan, Greek hopes waned and were undermined, ebbing away with their strength in battle broken, the goddess now against them. This she made evident to them all with signs and portents, just as they set her statue up in camp. The eyes cast upward glowed with crackling flames, and salty sweat ran down the body. Then, I say it in awe, three times the magic number, up from the ground, the apparition of the goddess rose in a lightning flash with shield and spear a tremble. So Athena's furious at the Greeks, and she has this apparition happen. Calchas divined at once that the sea crossing must be attempted in retreat, that Pergamum cannot be torn apart by Argive Greek swords, unless at Argos first they beg new omens, carrying homeward the divine power. So the Greeks cannot conquer Troy unless they go back to Greece first. Pergamum, Troy, can't be torn apart by Greek swords unless at Greece first they beg new omens, carrying homeward the divine power brought over seas in ships. Now they are gone before the wind to the fatherland Mycenae, gone to enlist new troops and gods. They'll cross the water again and be here unforeseen. So Calchas read the portents. Warned by him, they set this figure up in reparation for the Palladium stolen, to appease the offended power and expiate the crime. So they left this horse to make up for stealing the Palladium. Enormous, though, he made them build the thing with timber braces towering to the sky, too big for the gates, because it doesn't want you guys to haul it inside. Not to be hauled inside and give the people back their ancient guardian. So this person who stayed behind to act like he hates the Greeks now, and now he's been accepted by all the Trojans, he says they made it too big for the gates on purpose so that you guys can't bring it in and get blessed and have this as a guardian. Line 260. If any hand here violates this gift to great Minerva, Athena, then extinction waits. Not for one only, would God it were so, but for the realm of Priam and all the Phrygians. So you can't chop this up, because if you chop it all up, you'll be cursed by Minerva, Athena. If this proud offering drawn by your hands should mount into your city, then so far as the walls of Pelops' town, the tide of Asia surges in war, that doom awaits our children. So if you Trojans pulled this big horse into your city, we Greeks would be doomed. And of course what he's getting to is they won't chop it up. They're going to actually break down their gate and walls to get this great big horse inside. And this was all, of course, Odysseus, who's called Ulysses here. It's all his plan. So this guy says, if you brought it into the city, you guys would doom the Greeks. This fraud of Sinon, his accomplished lying, this is Aeneas telling the story again, won us over. A tall tale and fake tears had captured us, whom neither Diomedes nor Larisian Achilles overpowered, nor 10 long years, nor all their 1,000 ships. And now another sign, more fearful still, broke on our blind, miserable people, filling us all with dread. Line 275, and this is the Laocoon. Laocoon, acting as Neptune's priest that day by lot, was on the point of putting to the knife a massive bull before the appointed altar, when, ah, look there. So what had Laocoon been telling them? Don't bring it in as a trick, it's a trick, it's a trick. And so he's going to sacrifice a bull to try and find out their will, because he's telling the opposite story that this Greek guy all tied up is telling. From Tenedos, on the calm sea, twin snakes. I shiver to recall it. Endlessly. And this is the picture of the Laocoon. This giant statue is at the Vatican. It's actually outside under a covered area. But this is that handout that you have, the Laocoon. Twin snakes, I shiver to recall it, endlessly coiling, uncoiling, swam abreast for shore. So they're coming over the water, their underbellies showing as their crests reared red as blood above the swell. Behind they glided with great undulating backs. Now came the sand of thrashed sea water foaming. Now they were on dry land, and we could see their burning eyes, fiery and suffused with blood, their tongues a flickering out of hissing maws. We scattered, pale with fright, but straight ahead they slid until they reached Laocoon. Each snake enveloped one of his two boys, twining about and feeding on the body. Next they ensnared the man, Laocoon, as he ran up with weapons, trying to save his sons. Coils like cables looped and bound him, twice round the middle, twice around his throat. They whipped their back scales and their heads towered, while with both hands he fought to break the knots, drenched in slime. Yeah, snaky slime. His headbands black with venom, sending to heaven his appalling cries like a slashed bull escaping from the altar. The fumbled axe shrugged off because he was just going to kill the bull. The pair of snakes now flowed away and made for the highest shrines, the citadel of pitiless Minerva Athena, where coiling they took cover at her feet under the rondure of her shield. All right, remember Minerva Athena, her main attribute is wisdom. And she's also known to be pitiless, and the snakes coil at her feet under her shield, which is where we see them in numerous statuary for Athena. New terrors ran in the shaken crowd. The word went round. Laocoon had paid, and rightfully, for profanation of the sacred hulk with his offending spear hurled at its flank. So Laocoon, for trying to warn them not to take the horse in, is actually killed. Athena makes sure that she sends out her snakes from across the sea. They come up, kill his sons, eat them, kill him, and that is Athena's way of making sure that that horse goes into the city. The offering must be hauled to its true home, they clamored. These are the Trojans. Votive prayers to the goddess must be said there to Athena. So we breached the walls and laid the city open. Everyone pitched in to get the figure underpinned with rollers, hempen lines around the neck, deadly pregnant with amnes. The horse crawled upward to the breach, so they took down their own city walls themselves and put it on wheels and hauled it in. And boys and girls sang hymns around the tow rope as for joy they touched it. Rolling on, it cast a shadow over the city's heart. O fatherland, O Ilium, home of gods, defensive wall renowned in war for Dardanus's people, there on the very threshold of the breach, it jarred to a halt four times. Four times the arms in the belly thrown together made a sound. So four times taking it in, the big horse kind of came to a halt and shook, and they heard a little clatter inside. Four times. Yet we strove, unmindful, deaf and blind, to place the monster on our blessed height. Then, even then, Cassandra's lips unsealed. And remember, Cassandra is the prophetess who gives prophecies, but they're never believed. Cassandra's lips unsealed, the doom to come. Lips by a god's command, never believed, or heeded by the Trojans. So pitiably we, for whom that day would be the last, made all our temples green with leafy festal boughs throughout the city, so they decorate the entire city. Line 336. As heaven turned, night from the ocean stream came on, profound in gloom on earth and sky, and Myrmidons in hiding, so Achilles' people in hiding. In their homes the two Cryans lay silent, wearied out, and sleep enfolded them. So all the Trojans go to sleep. The Argive fleet, the Greek fleet, drawn up in line abreast, left left Tenidos, where they were hidden, through the aloof Min's moon's friendly stillness, and made for the familiar shore. Flame signals shone from the command ship. Sinon, favored by what the gods unjustly had decreed, stole out to tap the pine walls and set free the Danans in the belly. So Sinon, this guy inside the horse, steals outside of the horse and taps on the pine walls and lets them all out. The Danans in the belly opened wide the horse-emitted Min. Gladly they dropped out of the cavern. Captains first, the Sandrus, Thynthlius, and the man of iron, Ulysses, Odysseus, hand over hand upon the rope, Acamas, Thoas, Neoptolemus, the son of Achilles, and Prince Machaon, Menelaus, and then the master builder, Epeius, who designed the horse decoy in the darkened city, buried deep in sleep and wine. So they've all been celebrating, drinking, and they're asleep, and they have no gate to the city. They made their way, cut the few sentries down, let their fellow soldiers in at the gate, and joined their combat companies as planned. That time of night it was when the first sleep, gift of the gods, begins for ill mankind, arriving gradually, delicious rest. In sleep, in dream, Hector appeared to me. So Hector appears to Aeneas to warn him, run away, run away, run away. So, because Hector's dead, remember? In sleep, in dream, Hector appeared to me, gaunt with sorrow, streaming tears, all torn as by the violent car on his death day, because remember, Hector's body was all ripped all apart, running around the city, and black with bloody dust, he puffed out feet, cut by the rawhide thongs. Ah, God, the look of him, how changed from that proud Hector who returned to Troy wearing Achilles' armies, or that one who pitched the torches on Danaan ships. His beard all filth, his hair matted with blood, showing the wounds, the many wounds received outside his father's city walls. I seemed myself to weep and call upon the man in grieving speech, brought from the depths of me, light of Dardania. So this is Aeneas in his dream talking to the apparition, which is Hector. Light of Dardania, Troy, best hope of Troy, what kept you from us so long, and where, and far from what place, O Hector, have you come? Long, long awaited, after so many deaths of friends and brothers, after a world of pain for all our folk and all our town. At last, bone weary, we behold you. What has happened to ravage your serene face? Why these wounds? And now this is the ghost of Hector talking to Aeneas, line 385. He wasted no reply on my poor questions, but heaved a great sigh from his chest and said, I give up and go, child of the goddess, Aeneas, child of Venus, save yourself out of these flames. The enemy holds the city walls, and from her height Troy falls in ruin. Fatherland and Priam have their due. If by one hand our towers could be defended, by this hand my own they would have been. Her holy things, her gods of hearth and household, Troy commends to you. Accept them as companions of your days. Go, find for them the great walls that one day you'll dedicate when you have roamed the sea. So this is the ghost of Hector telling Aeneas, go and found a great city, and be sure and take the gods with you. As this he said, he brought out from the sanctuary chaplets and Vesta, lady of the hearth, with her eternal fire. While I dreamed, the turmoil rose with anguish in the city more and more, although Anchises' house lay in seclusion. So Aeneas's dad's his house, where he and Anchises lived, muffled among trees, the din at the grim onset grew, and now I shook off sleep, so now he wakes up. I climbed to the rooftop to cup my ears and listen, and the sound was like the sound of that a grass fire makes in grain, whipped by a south wind, or a torrent forming out of the mountainside to strew in ruined fields, happy crops, the yield of plowing teams. So this is another long simile. What was it like when he climbs up onto his house there on the outskirts of town? He didn't hear, didn't wake him up till just recently. He climbs up there, and what's it like? It's like a firestorm going through a field, or woodlands borne off in the field. In wonder, the shepherd listens to a rocky peak. I knew then what our trust had won for us, knew the Danaan fraud, knew the Greek fraud. Deiphobus, great house in flames, already caving in under the overpowering god of fire. Ucalegans already caught nearby. The glare lighting the straits beyond Sigeum. The cries of men, the wild calls of trumpets. So all the heroes, their houses are already on fire. To arm was my first maddened impulse. Not that anyone had a fighting chance in arms. Only I burned to gather up some force for combat and demand some high redoubt. So fury drove me, and it came to me that meeting death was beautiful in arms. Then here here, eluding the Achaean, the Greek spears, came Panthus, Orthe's son, priest of Apollo, carrying holy things, our conquered gods, and pulling a small grandchild along. He ran despairing to my doorway. "Where's the crux, Panthus?" I said. "What strong point shall we hold?" A crux is a critical point or moment. So he says, "Where's the crux? Where's the critical point?" Because what Aeneas wants to do is get his armor and go fight the Greeks, even though it's impossible. Everything's already burning down. That's his instinct, is to go fight. He has to have a reason to run away, or he's going to look like a coward. And he's telling this story, remember, to Queen Dido. So he has to have a good reason for running away. So the priest here is bringing him the gods. Before I could say more, he groaned and answered, "The last day for Dardania, Troy, has come, the hour not to be fought off any longer. Trojans we have been, Ilium, Troy has been, the glory of the two Koreans, the Trojans, is no more. Black Jupiter has passed it on to Argus, Greek. Greeks are the masters in our burning city." And if the priest tells you this, you just have to believe it. "Tall as a cliff set in the heart of town, their horse pours out armed men, the conqueror gloating Sinon, brews out conflagrations. Troops hold the gates, as many thousand men as ever come from great Mycenae. Others block the lanes with crossed spears, glittering in a combat line. Sword blades are drawn for slaughter. Even the first guards at the gates can barely offer battle or blindly make a stand." In other words, it's hopeless to fight. "Impelled by these words," line 450, "by the powers of heaven, into the flames I go, into the fight where the harsh fury and the din and shouting, skyward rising calls." So Aeneas telling Dido the story, "I ran into the fight. Crossing my path in moonlight, five fell in line with me, companions, Ripheus, Epteus, a great soldier, Hippanus, Dymas, cleaving to my side with young Corobus, Myrgodon's son. It happened that in those very days this man had come to Troy, aflame with passion for Cassandra, bringing to Priam and the Phrygians a son-in-law's right hand. Unlucky one, to have been deaf to what his bride foretold. Now when I saw them grouped on edge for battle, I took it all in and said briefly, 'Soldiers,'" so this is Aeneas saying to these guys, we're all going to go fight and die. "'Soldiers, brave as you are to no end, if you crave to face the last fight with me, and no doubt of it, how matters stand for each one of us can see. The gods by whom this kingdom stood are gone, gone from the shrines and altars. You defend a city lost in flames. Come, let us die. We'll make a rush into the thick of it. There the conquered have won safety, hope for none.' The desperate odds doubled their fighting spirit. From that time on, like predatory wolves what's it like as these six guys go out? I think there's six of them. They go out to just fight a whole thousands of Greek people. What was it like? Like predatory wolves in fog and darkness, when a savage hunger drives them blindly on, and cubs in lairs lie waiting with dry, famished jaws. Just so through arrow flights and enemies we ran toward our sure death, straight for the city's heart. Cavernous black night over and around us. Who can describe the havoc of the night, or tell the deaths, or tally wounds with tears? The ancient city falls after dominion many long years, in windows on the streets, in homes on solemn porches of the gods, dead bodies lie, and not alone the Trojans pay the price with their hearts' blood. At times manhood returns to fire even the conquered, and Danaan conquerors fall. Grief everywhere, everywhere terror, and all shapes of death. Androgeus was the first to cross our path, leading a crowd of Greeks. He took for granted that we were friends and hailed us cheerfully. So because they're running there with armor, they think they've killed everybody. They think they're friends. "Men, get a move on. Are you made of lead to be so late and slow? The rest are busy carrying plunder from the fires and towers, and you just landed from the ships." His words were barely out, and no reply forthcoming credible to him, when he knew himself fallen among enemies. So as soon as he says, "Okay, you guys, come on, did you really just get off the ships?" then he realizes, "Oh my goodness, these are Trojans, they're my enemies." Thunderstruck, he halted foot and voice, and then recoiled like one who steps down on a lurking snake in a briar patch. What was it like when he realized he's facing enemies and not friends? It's like a guy recoiling when he steps down on a terrible snake in a briar patch and jerks back, terrified, as the angry thing rears up all puffed and blue. So backward went Androgeus, in other words, he's a coward, in panic. We were all over them in a moment, cut and thrust, and as they fought an unknown ground, they were fighting in ground we know it was our home. Startled, unnerved, we killed them everywhere. So fortune filled our sails at first. Coroebus, elated at our feat in his own courage, said, "Friends, come follow fortune. She has shown the way to safety, shown she's on our side. We'll take their shields and put on their insignia. In other words, let's dress up like Greeks. Trickery, bravery, who asks in war? The enemy will arm us." He put on the plumed helmet of Androgeus, took the shield with blazon and the Greek sword to his side. Ripheus, Dymas, all were pleased to do it, making the still fresh trophies our equipment. Then we went on, passing among the Greeks, protected by our own gods, now no longer. Many a combat hand-to-hand we fought in the Black Night, and many a Greek we sent to Orcus down in the underworld. There were some who turned and ran back to the ships and shore, some shamefully clamored again into the horse to hide in the familiar paunch. So here Aeneas, telling the story to Queen Dido, makes the Greeks out, even though they had overwhelming odds, makes them out as cowards, some of them even running back to their ships, and with only from 6 men. "When gods are contrary, they stand by no one. Here before us came Cassandra, Priam's virgin daughter, dragged by her long hair out of Minerva, Athena's shrine." And of course, that would be, this is the ultimate breach of hospitality, to go and get Priam's daughter, who is a priestess herself, and to violate her. "Lifting her brilliant eyes in vain to heaven, her eyes alone as her white hands were bound, Coroebus, infuriated, would not bear it, but plunged into the midst to find his death. We all went after him, our swords at play, but here first, from the temple gable's height, we met a hail of missiles from our friends, pitiful execution by their error, who thought us Greek from our Greek plumes and shields." So they're going in trying to save Cassandra, and they can't, because there's other Trojan guys who think they're Greeks and don't know that they're Trojans dressed up as Greeks, so even their own people are throwing missiles at them. Then with a groan of anger, line 5, 4, 5. "Then with a groan of anger, seeing the virgin wrested from them, Danaans, Trojans from all sides railed and attacked us. Fiery Ajax, Atreus's son, Dolopians in a mass." And what was it like? As when a cyclone breaks, conflicting winds will come together, westward, south wind, east wind, riding high, out of the dawnland, forests bend and roar, and raging all in spume, Nereus with his trident churns the deep. Then some, whom we had taken by surprise under cover of night throughout the city and driven off, came back again. They knew our shields and arms for liars now they knew we were Trojans, our speech alien to our own, they heard our Trojan accent. They overwhelmed us, Coroebus fell at the warrior goddess's altar. So Coroebus fell trying to save Cassandra, killed by Peneleus, and Ripheus fell, a man uniquely just among the Trojans, the soul of equity, but the gods would have it differently. Hippanius, Demas died, shot down by friends, nor did your piety, Panthus, nor Apollo's fillets shield you as you went down. Ashes of Ilium, Troy, flames that consumed my people. Here I swear that in your downfall I did not avoid one weapon, one exchange with the Danaans, and if it had been fated, my own hand had earned my death. But we were torn away from that place. Iphitus and Peleus too, one slow with age, one wounded by Ulysses, Odysseus, called by the clamor at the hall of Priam. Truly we found here a prodigious fight, as though there were none elsewhere, not a death in the whole city. Mars gone berserk. So Mars, Ares, the war god, has just gone berserk. I love that line. Danaans in a rush to scale the roof, the gate besieged by a tortoise shell of overlapping shields. Ladders clung to the wall, and men strove upward before the very doorposts. On the rungs left hand putting the shield up and the right reaching for the cornice. The defenders wrenched our upper works and roof tiles. These from missiles as they saw the end, preparing to fight back even on the edge of death. So they're even ripping things off their roof to use them as missiles to throw at them. And gilded beams, ancestral ornaments, they rolled down on the heads below. In hall, others, line 590, others with swords drawn held the entranceway, packed there waiting. Now we plucked up heart to help the royal house, to give our men a respite and to add our strength to theirs, though all were beaten, and we had for entrance a rear door, secret, giving on a passage between the palace halls. In other days, Andromache, poor lady, often used it, going alone to see her husband's parents, or taking Astyanax to his grandfather. So now we have the secret doorway. It's a secret escape passageway. Line 600, I climbed high on the roof, where hopeless men were picking up and throwing futile missiles. Here was a tower like a promontory rising toward the stars above the roof. All Troy, the Danaan ships, the Achaean camp, were visible from this. Now close behind it, with crowbars, where the flooring made loose joints, we pried it from its bed and pushed it over. Down with a rending crash in sudden ruin. Wide over the Danan lines it fell, but fresh troops moved up, and the rain of stones with every kind of missile never ceased. Just at the outer doors of the vestibule sprang Pyrrhus, and Pyrrhus is the son of Achilles and Deidara. Pyrrhus is Neoptolemus, but here he's called Pyrrhus. So Neoptolemus is Pyrrhus. It's the son of Achilles and Deidamia, all in bronze and glittering. And what was it like? As a serpent, hidden, swollen underground by a cold winter, writhes into the light on vile grass fed, his old skin cast away, renowned and glossy, rolling slippery coils with lifted underbelly, rearing sunward and triple tongue aflicker. Close behind him, giant Periphas, so that's what it like with his coming like a slithering snake. Close behind him, giant Periphas and Automedon, his armor bearer, once Achilles' driver, besieged the place with all the young of Scythus, hurling the torches of the palace roof. Pyrrhus, remember this is Neoptolemus, Achilles' son, shouldering forward with an axe, broke down the stony threshold, forced apart hinges and brazen door jams, and chopped through one panel of the door, splitting the oak to make a window a great breach. And there before their eyes an inner halls lay open, the courts of Priam and the ancient kings, with men-at-arms ranked in the vestibule. From the interior came sounds of weeping, pitiful commotion, wails of women high pitched, rising in the formal chambers to ring against the silent golden stars. And through the palace, mothers, wild with fright, ran to and fro or clung to doors and kissed them. Pyrrhus, with his father's brawn, stormed on. Neoptolemus, with his father's strength, no bolts or bars or men availed to stop him. Under his battering, the double doors were torn out of their sockets and fell inward. Sheer force cleared the way. The Greeks broke through into the vestibule, cut down the guards, and made the wide hall seethe with men-at-arms. So now they're into the very palace itself. A tumult greater than when dikes are burst. What was it like breaking down into that hall? A tumult greater than when dikes are burst, and a foaming river swirling out in flood whelms every parapet and races on through fields and over all the lowly land plains, bearing off pens and cattle. I myself saw Neoptolemus, that's Pyrrhus, furious with blood in the entranceway, and saw the two Atreidae, and that would be Agamemnon and Menelaus. Hecuba I saw, Queen Hecuba, and her 100 daughters, Priam before the altars with his blood drenching the fires that he himself had blessed, because they killed Priam right on the altar, which was a big offense to the gods. Line 655. Those 50 bridal chambers, hope of a line so flourishing, those doorways, high and proud, adorned with takings of barbaric gold, we were all brought low. Fire had them, or the Greeks. What was the fate of Priam, you may ask? Line 660. Seeing his city captive, seeing his own royal portals rent apart, his enemies in the inner rooms, the old man uselessly put on his shoulders, shaking with old age, armor unused for years, belted a sword on, and made for the masked enemy to die. So wonderful, awesome, brave, powerful King Priam, way too old to fight in a battle, puts on his armor to go out to battle. Makes him noble. Under the open sky in a central court stood a big altar. Near it, a laurel tree of great age. And remember, laurel tree is sacred to Apollo. Leaning over in deep shade, embowered the Penates. So the household gods of the Trojans are near this big laurel tree. At this altar, Queen Hecuba and her daughters, like white doves blown down in a black storm, clung together, so they're clinging together at the altar, all the women, enfolding holy images in their arms. Now, seeing Priam in a young man's gear, she called out, "My poor husband, what mad thought drove you to buckle on those weapons? Where are you trying to go? The time is past for help like this, for this kind of defending. Even if my own Hector," who's dead, remember, "could be here, come to me now. The altar will protect us, or else you'll die with us." She drew him close, heavy with years, and made a place for him to rest on the consecrated stone. Now see Polites, one of Priam's sons, escaped from Pyrrhus, Neoptolemus, Achilles' sons, butchery and on the run through enemies and spears, down colonnades, through empty courtyards, wounded. Close behind comes Pyrrhus, Neoptolemus, Achilles' son, burning for the death stroke, has him, catches him now, and lunges with the spear. The boy has reached his parents, and before them goes down, pouring out his life with blood. Now Priam, in the very midst of death, would neither hold his peace nor spare his anger. So this is Priam cursing the hubris, the sin of all the Greeks. "For what you've done, for what you've dared," he said, "if there is care in heaven for atrocity, may the gods render fitting thanks, reward you as you deserve. You forced me to look on at the destruction of my son, defiled a father's eyes with death, that great Achilles you claim to be the son of, and you lie, was not like you to Priam, his enemy. To me, who threw himself upon his mercy, he showed compunction, gave me back for burial the bloodless corpse of Hector, and returned me to my own realm." So this is King Priam saying to Achilles' son, "Even your dad Achilles gave me back Hector so I could go bury him, and here you are, his son, you know, killing my son right in front of my own eyes." The old man threw his spear with feeble impact, blocked by the ringing bronze. It hung there harmless from the jutting boss. Then Pyrrhus, Achilles' son, answered, "You'll report the news to Pelides, my father. Don't forget my sad behavior, the degeneracy of Neoptolemus. Now die." So he says, "Yeah, when you go to hell today, don't forget to tell my father how awful I am. Now die." With this, to the altar step itself, he dragged him trembling, slipping in the pooled blood of his son, and took him, King Priam, by the hair with his left hand. The sword flashed in his right. Up to the hilt, he thrust it in his body, King Priam. So Achilles' son just killed King Priam. That was the end of Priam's age, the doom that took him off, with Troy in flames before his eyes, his towers headlong fallen, line 725. He that in other days had ruled in pride so many lands and peoples, the power of Asia, because Troy is in Asia. On the distant shore, the vast trunk, headless, lies without a name. So, of course, this is Aeneas telling Queen Dido that poor Priam lays there, you know, headless. "For the first time that night, inhuman shuddering took me, head to foot. I stood unmanned." So this is Aeneas. It's like, okay, this actually unmanned me to see our king killed like that. "And my dear father's image came to mind as our king, just his age, mortally wounded, gasped his life away before my eyes. Creusa came to mind too, left alone, the house plundered, danger to little Iulius. Ascanius. I looked around to take stock of my men, but all had left me." So now Aeneas has watched this horrific thing happen to the king, and then he starts thinking of his own father and his wife left alone without help, and he looks around to take stock of his men, but all had left me, utterly played out. Now he's alone. Everybody's left him. "Giving their beaten bodies to the fire or plunging from the roof." So now Aeneas feels he's truly alone. "It came to this, that I stood there alone. And then I saw, lurking beyond the door sill of the Vesta, in hiding, silent in that place reserved, the daughter of Tyndarus." Now Aeneas, that's Helen. Line 745. So Aeneas, he's been deserted. Now he's starting to think about his wife and son. No use fighting. Everybody's gone. And now he sees Helen, the daughter of Tyndarus. "Glares of fires lighted my steps this way and that, my eyes glancing over the whole scene everywhere. That woman, terrified of the Trojans' hate for the city overthrown, terrified, too, of Danaan vengeance, her abandoned husband's angers after years. Helen, that fury, both to her own homeland and Troy, had gone to earth a hated thing before the altars. Now fires blazed up in my own spirit, a passion to avenge my fallen town and punish Helen's whorishness." So now Achilles is thinking of killing Helen. "Shall this one look untouched on Sparta and Mycenae after her triumph, going like a queen to see her home and husband, kin and children with Trojan girls for escorts, Phrygian slaves? Must Priam perish by the sword for this?" So Aeneas is saying, really, am I going to let her just go home in triumph? "Troy burn for this," looking for Helen. "Dardania's littoral," which Dardania's coast, "be soaked in blood so many times for this," meaning Helen. "Not by my leave. I know no glory comes of punishing a woman. That feat can bring no honor. Still, I'll be approved for snuffing out a monstrous life, for a just sentence carried out. My heart will teem with joy in this avenging fire, and the ashes of my kin will be appeased." So he's saying he's going to do the world a favor and kill Helen. Except, "so ran my thoughts. I turned wildly upon her. But at that moment, clear before my eyes, never before so clear, in a pure light, stepping before me, radiant through the night, my loving mother came." So Aeneas is just going to kill Helen, and Aphrodite Venus steps in between them. Immortal, tall, and lovely as the lords of heaven know her. Catching me by the hand, she held me back. Because remember, Aphrodite's the whole reason that Helen was at Troy. Because Helen was the prize in Alexander, the prince of Troy in Paris, she was the prize. Catching me by the hand, she held me back. Then with her rose-red mouth reproved me. So this is Aphrodite talking to her son Aeneas, because remember, Aphrodite gave Helen to Paris Alexander as the prize in the beauty pageant. And that's why Juno is so angry, and that's why Aphrodite doesn't want Helen killed. Son, why let such suffering goad you on to fury past control? Where is your thoughtfulness for me, for us? Will you not first revisit the place you left your father, worn and old, or find out if your wife, Creusa, lives, and the young boy Ascanius, Ilius, all these cut off by Greek troops foraging everywhere? Like, are you really here to kill Helen? Shouldn't you be looking for your wife and son? Had I not cared for them, fire would by now have taken them. Their blood gutted the sword. So Aphrodite here is saying she has rescued his wife and son so far. You must not hold the woman of Laconia, that's the region of Sparta where Helen is from, that hated face, the cause of this, nor Paris. The harsh will of the gods it is, the gods that overthrows the splendor of this palace. So don't blame Helen. And brings Troy from her height into the dust. It's the gods. Look over there. I'll tear away the cloud that curtains you and films your mortal sight, the fog around you. Have no fear of doing your mother's will or balk at obeying her. Look, where you see high masonry thrown down, stone torn from stone, and with billowing smoke and dust, Neptune is shaking from their beds the walls that his great trident pried up. So Aphrodite is allowing Aeneas to see what's really happening. She's pulling back the cloak of mortality so that he can see that it's actually the gods destroying the Trojan city using the Greeks. So his great trident is even prying up, undermining, toppling the whole city down. And look, Juno, Hera, in all her savagery, holds the Scaean gates and raging in steel armor, calls her allied army from the ships upon the citadel. Turn, look, Pallas, Tritonia, Athena, couched in a storm cloud, lightning with her Gorgon, the Gorgon, the Medusa. The father himself empowers the Danaans, urges assaulting gods on the defenders. Away, child, put an end to toiling so. I shall be near to see you safely home. She hid herself in the deep gloom of night. And now the dire forms appeared to me of great immortals, enemies of Troy. I knew the end then. Ilium was going down in fire. The Troy of Neptune going down. And what was it like? As in high mountains, when the countrymen have notched an ancient ash, so they're trying to cut down a tree, then make their axes ring with might and main, chopping away to fell the tree, ever on the point of falling, shaken through all its foliage, and the treetop nodding, bit by bit the strokes prevail, until it gives a final groan at last, and crashes down in ruin from the height. That's what it was like, watching the gods topple Troy, like watching people chop down a big tree. Now I descended where the goddess guided, clear of the flames and clear of enemies, for both retired. So gained my father's door, so now he's back at his dad's house where his family is, my ancient home. I looked for him at once, my first wish being to help him to the mountains. But with Troy gone, he set his face against it, not to prolong his life or suffer exile. So his dad doesn't want to leave. The rest of you, all in your prime, he said, make your escape. You are still hale and strong. Line 835. If heaven's lords had wished me a longer span, they would have saved this home for me. I call it more than enough that once before I saw my city taken and wrecked and went on living. Here is my deathbed here. Take leave of me. Depart now. I'll find death with my sword arm. The enemy will oblige. They'll come for spoils. Burial can be dispensed with. All these years I've lingered in my impotence. I can't do anything. I'm too old. At odds with heaven, since the father of gods and men breathed high winds of thunderbolt upon me and touched me with his fire. He spoke on, and in the same vein, inflexible. So his father's inflexible. He's not going to leave. Not going to make him leave. The rest of us, to Creusa and Ascanius and the servants, begged him in tears not to pull down with him our lives as well, adding his own dead weight to the fate's pressure. But he would not budge. He held to his resolve and to his chair. I felt swept off again to fight in misery, longing for death. What choices now were open? What chance had I? Did you suppose, my father, that I could tear myself away and leave you? Unthinkable! How could a father say it? Now, if it please the powers above that nothing stand in this great city, if your heart is set on adding your own death and ours to that of Troy, the door is wide open for it. Pyrrhus will be here, Achilles' son, splashed with Priam's blood. He kills the son before his father's eyes, the father at the altars. My dear mother, was it for this, through spears and fire, you brought me? To see the enemy deep in my house, to see my son Ascanius, my father, and near them both Creusa butchered in one another's blood? My gear, men, bring my gear. The last light calls the conquered. Give me back to the Greeks. Let me take up the combat once again. We shall not all die this day avenged. I buckled on sword belt and blade and slid my left forearm into the shield strap, turning to go out, but at the door Creusa hugged my knees, then held up little Eulalius to his father, so she is begging him, holding him by the knees. If you are going out to die, take us to face the whole thing with you. If experience leads you to put some hope in weaponry, such as you now take, guard your own house here. When you have gone, to whom is Eulalius left? Your father, wife, one called that long ago. She went on, and her wailing filled the house, but then a sudden portent came. So Aphrodite is going to give them a sign of encouragement. It's a portent. A marvel amid his parents' hands and their sad faces. A point on Eulalius, this is Ascanius, Eulalius, a point on Eulalius's head seemed to cast light, a tongue of flame that touched but did not burn him, licking his fine hair, playing round his temples. We in panic beat at the flaming hair and put the sacred fire out with water. Father Anchises lifted his eyes to heaven and lifted up his eyes, his voice in joy. That was almost like when Athena caused him to glow and all the stuff shoot out from his head in the Iliad. And so this is happening to little Ascanius Eulalius, as though, this is the one, you got to save this one. So Anchises says to Jupiter, "Omnipotent Jupiter," this is the old man, "if prayers affect you, look down upon us. That is all I ask. If by devotion to the gods we earn it, grant us a new sign and confirm this portent." The old man barely finished when it thundered, a loud crack on the left. Out of the sky, through depths of night, a star fell, trailing flame, and glided on, turning the night to day. We watched it pass over the roof and go to hide its glare, its trace in Ida's wood. But still behind the luminous furrow shone, and wide zones fumed with sulfur, so it stinks. Now indeed, my father, overcome, addressed the gods and rose in worship of the blessed star. Now, no more delay, I'll follow you. Where you conduct me, there I'll go. Gods of my fathers, preserve this house, preserve my grandson. Yours this potent was. Portent was. Troy's life is in your power. I yield. I go as your companion, son. Then he was still. We heard the blazing town crackle more loudly, felt the scorching heat, so the fire's getting nearer. Line 921. And so now Aeneas is talking to his dad. Then come, dear father, arms round my neck. I'll take you on my shoulders. No great weight. Whatever happens, both will face one danger. Find one safety. Eulalius will come with me, my wife at a good interval behind. This, in book 2, line 925, is one of my favorite lines in this book. My wife at a good interval behind. So dad, go get the hearth gods. We're going to meet you at the funeral mound. If we get separated, we all know how to meet there. He's got his dad over his back. He's got Ascanius in hand. And Creusa is following a good interval behind. That's a hint. At the portent. Servants, give your attention to what I say. At the gate inland, there's a funeral mound and an old shrine of Ceres the bereft. Near it, an ancient cypress kept alive for many years by our father's piety. By various routes, we'll come to that one place. Father, carry our hearth guards, our penates. That means Aeneas is pious. It would be wrong for me to handle them. Just come from such hard fighting. He doesn't want to touch them because his hands are all bloody. Bloody work, until I wash myself in running water. When I had said this, now this is Aeneas telling the whole story to Queen Dido. When I had said this, over my breadth of shoulder and bent neck, I spread out a lion skin for tawny cloak and stooped to take his weight. Then little Eulalius put his hand in mine and came with shorter steps behind his father. My wife fell in behind. Da, 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 da. Through showered places on we went, and I, lately unmoved by any spears thrown, any squads of Greeks, felt terror now. at every eddy of wind, alarm at every sound, alert and worried alike for my companions and my burden. I had got near the gate, and now I thought we had all made it all the way, when suddenly a noise of running feet came near at hand, and peering through the gloom ahead, my father cried out, "Run, boy, here they come! I see flame light on shields, bronze shining." I took fright, and some unfriendly power, I know not what, stole all my addled wits, for as I turned aside from the known way, entering a maze of pathless places on the run, so now they drove him down somewhere where he doesn't know where he is. He got lost. Alas, Creusa, taken from us by grim fate. Remember, this is Aeneas talking to Dido. Aeneas is widowed. Dido's widowed. The boy is sitting on her lap, Cupid making her fall in love, and she's hearing what a brave hero he was to want to go rescue his wife. Alas, Creusa, taken from us by grim fate. Did she linger or stray or sink in weariness? There is no telling. Never would she be restored to us. Never did I look back or think to look for her, lost as she was, until we reached the funeral mound and shrine of venerable Ceres. Here at last we all come together, but she was not there. She alone failed her friends, her child, her husband. Out of my mind, whom did I not accuse? What man or god? What crueler loss had I beheld? That night the city fell. Ascanius, my father, and the two Crean Penates, the hearth gods, I left in my friend's charge, and hid them well in a hollow valley. I turned back alone into the city, cinching my bright harness. So he's going to go back and get his wife. Nothing for it but to run the risks again, go back again, comb all of Troy, and put my life in danger as before, first by the town wall, then the gate, all gloom through which I had come out, and so on backward, tracing my own footsteps through the night, and everywhere my heart misgave me, even stillness had its terror, then to our house, thinking she might, just might, have wandered there. Danaans had got in and filled the place, and at the instant fire they had set, consuming it, went roofward in a blast, flames leaped and seethed, in heat to the night sky. So the Greeks burnt his home. It's not there anymore. I pressed on, line 990, to see Priam's hall and tower, in the bare colonnades of Juno's shrine. Two chosen guards, Phoenix and hard Ulysses, Odysseus, kept watch over the plunder. Piled up here were treasures of old Troy from every quarter, torn out of burning temples, altars, tables, robes, and golden bowls. Drawn up around them, boys and frightened mothers stood in line. I even dared to call out in the night. So not only did he go all the way back home and then all the way to the castle, he even dared to shout out in the night. I filled the streets with calling. In my grief, time after time, I groaned and called, Creusa! Frantic and endless quest from door to door. Then, to my vision, her sad wraith appeared. Creusa's ghost, larger than life, before me. Chilled to the marrow, I could feel the hair on my head rise, the voice clot in my throat. But she spoke out to ease me of my fear. So this is the voice of the ghost of Creusa, his wife. What's to be gained by giving way to grief so madly, my sweet husband? Nothing here has come to pass except as heaven willed. You may not take Creusa with you now. It was not so ordained, nor does the Lord of High Olympus, Zeus, give you leave. For you long exile waits and long sea miles to plow. You shall make landfall on Hesperia, that's Italy, where Lydian Tiber flows, Tiber, the main river, with gentle peace between rich farmlands, and the years will bear glad peace, a kingdom and a queen for you. So here's his own wife, the ghost of his own wife, telling him, there'll be another woman for you, a queen for you. Dismiss these tears for your beloved Creusa. I shall not see the proud homelands of Myrmidons or of the Delopians, or go to serve Greek ladies, Dardan lady that I am, and daughter-in-law of Venus the divine, because Aphrodite is Aeneas's mother. Then little Creusa is actually the daughter-in-law of Venus. But so she says, I'm dead. Don't worry, at least I won't go be a slave to the Greeks. No, the great mother of the gods, that's Hera, detains me here on these shores. Farewell now, cherish still your son and mine. With this she left me weeping, wishing that I could say so many things, and faded on the tenuous air. So she disappears. Three times I tried to put my arms around her neck, three times enfolding nothing. Line 1030. As the wraith slipped through my fingers, bodiless as wind, or like a flitting dream. Remember, this is Aeneas talking to Dido, telling her the story of how much he loved his precious wife. So in the end, as night waned, I rejoined my company, and there to my astonishment I found new refugees in a great crowd, men and women gathered for exile, young, pitiful people coming from every quarter, minds made up with their belongings for whatever lands I'll lead them to by sea. So he gets back to the shore. Not only his dad and son are there, but a whole bunch of other people too, Trojan exiles, looking for him to lead them wherever he will lead them. The morning star now rose on Ida's ridges, bringing day. Greeks had secured the city gates. No help or hope of help existed. So I resigned myself, picked up my father, and turned my face toward the mountain range. End of book 2.